This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Hillary Clinton's bid for the White House looks unstoppable unless Black folks fail to turn out in large numbers in 2016. And where is the Black Lives Matter movement headed? We'll hear from Dr. Cornel West, former political prisoner Marshall Conway, and Reverend Osagyefu Sekou. But first, we have an extended conversation with Philip Agnew of the Dream Defenders, the young people who embarked on a mission of social transformation in the wake of Trayvon Martin's killing in Florida 3 years ago. Agnew thinks it's a good thing that President Obama has moved to limit the kinds of military weapons, gear, and vehicles that can be sold or transferred to local police. However, Agnew says Obama's executive order doesn't get to the heart of the problem.
The movement is for something far larger than just that. I don't want to be dismissive, though, of that important step, and not because I owe anything to President Obama, but simply because our police departments have always been an extension of the militarized force. We've always lived in occupied communities. And so that demand, though it was a reform, I look at it as almost a non-reformist reform in that the incentive to not only treat our communities like police states and occupied territory is increased exponentially when you have the type of military-grade weaponry that was put at the disposal of a lot of these police departments and police officers, which many of which happen to be former military personnel at a period. And so I do think scaling down on the type of artillery and ammunition and weaponry and vehicles that they have at their disposal can curtail the impetus to use them because they don't have them. Now, what does it strike at the true culture of police departments, which I've said over and over again, has a culture of contempt for Black people, for Latino people, for poor people, for young people? I don't think it even scratches the surface of that, because before they had tanks and before they had SWAT vehicles, before they had tear gas, they had billy clubs and they used those whenever they could and as often as they could. And so it doesn't really matter at the end of the day what type of weapon they're using. If we're not working on the programming and the culture of our police department, then we haven't really scratched the surface of what this movement is demanding of the state, which is an end to state violence in its many forms, in its varied forms. And so attacking the police, I think, is where this era and where this moment is positioning our movement. But the movement is for something far greater. It's a complete transformation in the way that our lives are governed, and the way that Black people and poor people are treated in this country. And that's going to take a lot more than an executive order.
And why is a confrontation with police and with the criminal injustice system the door that one walks through in search of this transformation of society as a whole?
Well, I don't know who said it, but the police department and police officers are many people's direct interaction with the state. So that is what you see every single day, usually. If you're not on public transportation or you don't work in the public sector, it can be said that with the exception of your waste management or garbage man, you don't interact with the state and its functions on a daily basis. So especially if you're Black, those interactions are always traumatic, always potentially deadly, always scary, always to be avoided. And so I think for a lot of people, to see that Black people, to see that women, to see that men, to see that immigrant folks are treated the way that they're treated, it kind of adds a lot of credence to the saying, it could happen to me. It could happen to me. It could happen to a family member, because it's not some far-fetched land or it's not in some industry that people don't have an interaction with. These killings and these murders are happening at the hands of people that we see every single day. And to add insult to injury, these are the people that we're asking to save us, to protect us, to serve us every single day. Now, you can have a debate on whether police were ever meant to do that. I don't think they were, but this is the equivalent of every day a doctor to being charged with malicious malpractice, meaning they were killing someone every single day. That would cause a lot of people to be very, very afraid, because not only is that an interaction that we're bound to have at some point in our life, at least annually, we hope, but also this is a person that you relinquish a whole lot of worry and a lot of care, because you anticipate that this person took an oath to protect you and to do everything within their power to protect your life and to protect your well-being. And so I think that is why this is a moment, or this is at this moment, where many people are talking about police brutality and state violence, because one, it seems to a lot of people who don't live in a black community or a poor community so awesome, so astounding that this is happening, but also it's a time when what was once invisible is now becoming more visible to people. And we say this is the type of shit that happens every single day in our communities, and now more and more people are taking notice. And I think it's a good thing that people are taking notice in this moment. It's what organizers and organizations do with this anger that is going to be the true testament of what this moment means.
Yes, how does one, how do you, in your interaction with your peers, move the conversation to other areas of transformation, into what folks might call the political economy?
Well, obviously, everyone always says it, but it is starting where people are. So, for example, I'll give you a good example. Right now, I'm headed to Jacksonville, Florida. There's a lot of anger in that community about recent police killings. There's a lot of anger in that community around the state attorney, Angela Corey, who was at the center of the Marissa Alexander, the Trayvon Martin, and the Jordan Davis trial. Well, Michael Dunn trial and George Zimmerman trial around the deaths of those young black men, and also pursued a venomous and aggressive campaign to put Marissa Alexander, a woman who was just defending herself, behind bars. And so there's a lot of anger in that community. And so let's say we're having a meeting today, which we are, and at that meeting, we're going to begin a discussion about it not just being these individual cases, but connecting them to other cases around the country, and then connecting it to a greater system. And what we say is, hey, these things are all connected, and they're all connected through one system, a system of injustice, a system of exploitation, a system of oppression that runs, governs, and that controls and oppresses us nationally and internationally. And what if we were to tell you that the same thing that's happening in Jacksonville, Florida, is not only happening around the state and around the country, but it's happening in Palestine, et cetera? And what if we were further to tell you that the system is broken, but it's actually working quite well? This is exactly how it was designed to work, to ensure that poor people, specifically black people, and now increasingly Latino folks and immigrants from other countries, are left at the bottom rung of society, and that we're left to fight and murder and kill each other instead of focusing on the true oppressors, which actually, let me blow your mind here, isn't all white people. White people, poor white people, benefit from the illusion of white privilege for them, but it's actually a smaller number of people. And the only way that that group of people has ever capitulated, for ever been in fear of their position, is through an organized opposition. So we've got to get organized, and we've got to talk about what we can do in Jacksonville, Florida, that'll give us some local power that'll have a national impact. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. And that's how we start the conversation. But they look different. We do men's circles in Miami, where a group of men come together and talk about the issues that affect them. Last week, we talked about depression and cognitive dissonance, you know. And this isn't just a bunch of college students who graduated from colleges. These are people from the community, and they might not use the word cognitive dissonance. And they're telling a group of other men, you know, I felt messed up ever since I was little. I thought I was crazy, blah, blah, blah. So connecting on multiple levels, on the mental level, there are some people that have figured it out mentally. On an emotional level, there are some people, a spiritual level, that have always felt like something wasn't right or that they were wrong. And on a physical level, that's moving these people into positions where they never thought to take go. And we think we can build up or continue to build up the movement of our outpost explorers.
You've compared the period we're in today with 1967 and 1968. How is that so, and how is this period different?
Well, I've been saying this, interesting to see something that you only said to a few people in confidence now be something that comes to fruition. I remember 2 years ago I was telling people that riots were going to happen, and I was saying that to people in Florida, to friends and colleagues. And the reason that I think that they're similar is we could look at it at multiple levels. So first, let's look at the surface level. In 1964, 1967, 1968, there were huge urban uprisings. Young black youth, disenfranchised, very angry, lacking in any opportunity, and then also seeing their leaders being taken away from them in Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Medgar Evers and a number of other people, even the three that were lost in Mississippi. After a culmination of all of those things, and I think even to a degree, folks losing Robert F. Kennedy, who for a time possessed a great deal of favor in the black community. And people were sick of that. And people rose up and people said they're not going to take it anymore. And many of the urban uprisings happened as a result of people dying, whether people we loved or people we knew or somebody we saw on the block being murdered and beaten and killed. And we decided we weren't going to take it anymore. So on the surface level, those things are strikingly similar. What we're also seeing is some similarities are that in both of those eras, there was a lack of faith in the dominant institutions to provide any manner of regress. And that means both in government, in church, and in state. And that also means in traditional black, quote-unquote, leadership. And so without seeing any manner to get their anger out, get folks' anger out, get their disappointment out, get their disenchantment out, get their grievances aired, then people are going to take to the streets, and they're going to destroy symbols of their oppression in every case. And so I see the similarities between those years. Also, in 1968, and during the entire era of the 60s, there was a lot more conversation. I think there was a lot more talk about the methods of resistance and whether nonviolence or whether a nonviolent movement or even greater than just nonviolence, whether a political program was going to be the way that folks are going to see true liberation. And that debate came to a head in a lot of ways and in a lot of places with people taking up arms through the Black Liberation Army and other groups, through the Black Panthers as well, who were forced to defend themselves. But you saw that discussion raging, and I think it's going to increase this year as well, the discussion around political and policy and legislative goals and ideals and whether there's other means for us to reach true liberation, true community determination. And so those are the similarities that I see. The difference is, I believe, is that I actually believe that now, currently, we're in a worse state. It hasn't gotten better. And the reason I say that is because the state has gotten smarter and more strategic and more technologically advanced. And so by smarter and more strategic, I think they've opened up more doors to capitalism, and they've opened up more doors for tokenism and exceptionalism. And so we've got really, 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 really stellar examples, and I mean stellar in a sarcastic way, of the American dream in the black community. And so we've got millionaires, potential billionaires. We've got a president of the United States. We've got mayors, sheriffs, council people, alder people, business executives. Now we have a far greater range where people can say, hey, you know what? If I just work hard, I keep my head down, don't disrupt, I could be a professional athlete. I could be a teacher. I could be a professor. I could be a banker. I could be any of those things. So all of those doors are open to me. And those doors are the very thing that really quell revolution when people actually believe that they could be accepted into the system and live a good quality of living through the system. And then also the technology, man. We give away so much information. I do the same thing. I tag my location where I'm at. I'm talking over the phone with you in a conversation that could be potentially listened to. They know where we're at, wherever we're going, and that they don't need to do undercover things. We give away so much information every single day. And so the state is a lot stronger, and we're way less organized. The left in general is way less organized. There's a lot more division. There's a lot more ego. And there's a whole lot less on-the-ground organizing going on than it was in 1968 or in the 60s in general. There was a bunch of organizations, but they were critical of each other, and they were building a movement. We don't have that.
With the events in Baltimore, the spotlight moved to a big city, a majority black city, with in place a long-standing black political class that is at least nominally in power. What kind of challenges did that present to this burgeoning movement?
Well, I wasn't actually in Baltimore. I never was able to go. I was able to talk to people, and hopefully the little bit I was able to connect people was helpful. So I'll say that. But my observation from afar, and I think that's an important thing to say, from never being on the ground there, only knowing a few of the organizers on the ground, was that what was different from Baltimore and Ferguson was that in Ferguson there was a great deal that was unpredictable. There was a great deal about that movement at the beginning that was very volatile. There was a great about a movement that was unorganized. And you can make a case that all of those things are negative things. I will make the case that those things provided what was an exciting movement moment for folks in Ferguson. Because the unpredictability of it, the volatile nature of it, the unorganized nature of it, on its head, it was really organized genuinely. But on its head, the lack of organized organization and structure provided a lot of pause for the state, I think. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know who to call in. They didn't know how to quell this. And so I think if that was different in Baltimore. I think they had an infrastructure there for folks to air their grievances, and I think that's why it didn't persist as long as Ferguson. Not to say that what was going on in Baltimore was not real and was not powerful and was not moving progress into the discussion around state violence and the role of young people and black people from the streets, working class people in the movement. But what I would say, there were some differences there that I saw early on from afar that I think in retrospect, in analysis, we'll see that sometimes the unpredictable, the untenable, the uncontrollable is actually what's most powerful at a moment, for a moment.
Sounds like something like creative tension and other terms that Dr. King used to use when talking about bringing crises to a boil.
I agree. I think the government always talks about their biggest fear is the lone wolf. And they usually use those in terms of talking about their anti-terrorist work. Their biggest fear for the FBI and the CIA and Homeland Security is always the lone wolf. And their biggest fear is because they can't predict that, the pathology of somebody like that. They can't surveil them as well because it could happen anywhere. And I think that is the fear that they always have had about any type of movement. It could happen anywhere. So I think at some point, if the movement is going to take itself seriously about really, really engaging in a real conflict with the state, we're going to have to find ways to build and to organize that are less monitorable, are less flashy in the social media realm until after they happen, of course. Because I do believe social media is a powerful tool if we use it. And also more clandestine as best that we can be, and more creative. You know, we've got to do a lot more to startle and to shake up the state. We've yet to really do that in a very long time, except for Ferguson.
And finally, the White House has at times seemed very eager to invite young activists into the White House. What's their purpose, and what is the purpose of going to the White House?
Well, I was one of those people, and I was invited and attended a meeting with President Obama, with other activists from Ferguson and from around the country, from Ohio and from New York, and I accepted that invitation. I actually wrote an article and have talked a few times with folks from a Black Agenda Report about my attendance there. And this is what I'll say, and I've said this since the beginning, and I'll continue to say it. That is an invitation that you take, and this is the reason why. There always must be some form of diplomacy. There always has to be some form of communication between warring sides. And I do look at it like that, and I always will look at it like that. Now, obviously, we are not in a more powerful position than the state, and so we weren't able to own the entire meeting, meaning I believe that the president and his announcements that day, which were already planned before we had that meeting, probably gained more traction than what we were able to produce out of that meeting. And so I guess in the short term, you would look at that as a victory for the president, a photo op for the president. But this is what I'll say, and I'm a skeptical person. The office of President Barack Obama at least did listen and would not have had that meeting had not people been going crazy in the streets all across the country. I'm not going to be co-opted. I'm not going to let anybody curtail what I say or my critiques for anybody. And so I could go into that room knowing full well that, and I have not been, and I've not been also asked by that office to do anything or say anything that I wouldn't have already said, or to not say anything that I would have already said. And they knew that and understood that, which is why I was the last person to actually get invited to the meeting, because of my true nature about that. There's value and there's usefulness in it. No matter what anybody wants to say, the way that corporations, the way that the right wing, the way that the folks that we view as our enemies or our opposition have built and solidified their power is through control of the political apparatus. Of course, they control the economic apparatus, but corporations in this age cannot continue to make the money that they make, cannot continue to sway the political interests that they do without control of those very political interests. And so we cannot avoid political power. I do my best to embrace any opportunity to engage in political opposition. That doesn't mean I'm doing a press conference with them afterwards. That doesn't mean I'm shaking hands and hugging them afterwards. But if there's no form of communication between the two warring sides, then really, what are we doing sometimes? That's a question that I would ask maybe rhetorically or to anybody that disagrees. What do you do in order to negotiate? You have to go to the negotiating table. And no, we weren't at a negotiating table at that meeting, and we know that. So I'm not under any illusion that that's what we were doing either. But an open form of communication, I think, is helpful. He's done some of the things we asked him to do and not done many of the other things that we asked of him, but we had to ask.
Philip Agnew of the Dream Defenders, speaking from Florida. Recent local elections in Philadelphia saw the lowest voter turnout in living memory. In some of the poorest black precincts, turnout barely reached 10% of registered voters. Dr. Tony Montero is an activist, a scholar, and a native Philadelphian who was fired from Temple University's African American Studies Department for political reasons, according to his supporters. Montero thinks the non-voting majority is sending a message.
Well, I think people recognized that the city has been run, whether the mayor is white like Ed Rendell or black like Wilson Good, John Street, and Michael Nutter. The city has been run for the 1%. Philadelphia is building a town while neighborhoods are in decline and public schools are being shut down and poverty increases and extreme poverty increases at even a more rapid pace than poverty itself is increasing. So people had no stake in this, and I think they were expressing their profound and I would say legitimate rejection of the governing classes of the city of Philadelphia, be they black, white, Hispanic, or otherwise.
Many of those districts that registered the lowest turnout are those that are most besieged by gentrification, and yet gentrification wasn't a big issue among the candidates who were running.
Absolutely. You know, and when we look at North Philadelphia, and as you know, Glenn, North Philadelphia is where Temple is situated. Among the poorest wards in the city, among the poorest wards in the country, are neighbors to Temple University, where gentrification is most intense and poverty is most intense, but neither poverty nor gentrification were discussed in the election. Pretty much nothing was discussed and nothing was advocated for. You know, those who voted were pretty much voting lesser of evils. You know, the city unions and 1199 and SEIU, those kind of public unions were with the white candidate, and they were voting against the black candidate who was for charter schools and busting unions and was financed by a hedge fund located in the suburbs right outside of Philadelphia. So the public unions had a direct stake in not having the black candidate, who was more or less a corporate candidate like Michael Nutter. However, you know, the unions, outside of their own particular interests, do not advocate for broad social policies, especially as relates to poverty. So the poor took matters into their own hands and decided not to vote at all, to reject the whole process. I think this is very, very significant going forward.
Well, this record-breaking level of non-involvement by the Democratic base does not augur well for the Democratic Party nationally or for Hillary Clinton's chances in Pennsylvania in 2016.
No question about it. Hillary Clinton or any other Democrat cannot win the state of Pennsylvania without a huge black turnout and 90% of the black electorate voting for the Democratic candidate. I don't think that's going to happen. If I were to make a prediction based upon what happened Tuesday here in Philadelphia, Hillary Clinton cannot win the state of Pennsylvania. And if Hillary Clinton cannot win the state of Pennsylvania, she cannot become the president of the United States.
Have we entered a period in which the Democratic Party is incapable, because of its ties to the bankers, of offering anything of substance to its base, especially black people?
To that period, I think we have entered the period where there is a crisis of legitimacy, what political scientists call a crisis of legitimacy, where those who govern no longer have the legitimate support of the people that they govern. The question is, how will they govern without the support of the people and still call it democracy? I think we are in a crisis, a political crisis, the likes of which we have not experienced, perhaps since the Civil War.
The black political class seems to be in a crisis as well. In 2008, they were all united behind a Barack Obama, whether the real one or the one that lived only in their minds. But now we see the fissures, and they're getting deeper.
Oh, yeah. And Philadelphia, in this last election, was an example of precisely that. A sharp split within the political class. And I'm not just talking about committeemen and ward leaders. I'm talking about the major political players, black political players in the city, were divided between the black candidate and the white, more liberal candidate. A sizable chunk, major players, major black players, went with the white candidate. And all of the public unions are led by blacks, and they went with the white candidate. So you had this division, and there's going to be tremendous bloodletting going forward. You know, it's going to be very, very interesting how this black political class tries to regroup, at least for 2016, certainly to make themselves, put themselves in a position to get some of that campaign money from the Hillary campaign.
What does it say, however, about this party that's supposed to be a mass party with lots of folks under its tent, and yet there is only one candidate, an anointed one, Hillary?
Oh, it says a lot. We've gone, and I think political scientists and journalists and activists have drawn attention to the fact that this is no longer democracy in the sense, not even an electoral democracy in the sense that we've come to expect. What we're looking at is two parties that are financed and run by and for what we call the 1%, the finance capitalists. We're kind of in what you could call an authoritarian type of regime in the United States. And another part of this, I would say, is, you know, in a lot of ways, we're looking at something that is not unlike crypto-fascism. But there is something at the core of this governing structure, which is more like what you may have seen in Germany under Hitler and in certain Latin American countries under their form of dictatorship. Without the open, yet open face of military control, but in fact, in essence, the same thing.
You interpreted the low voter turnout in Philadelphia as not being based on apathy, but an actual rejection of the process as it was presented to the people. Does that mean that we're looking at a volatility within at least the black polity that is in contrast to, oh, the last 10 or 15 years?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think the end of the Obama symbology is the beginning of a new politics at the grassroots level. I think this is most pronounced and most clearly articulated by young people, that the electoral process and their hangers-on are not the path to social change. And so they will reject all sides, including Bernie Sanders, in the sense that they will choose the path of civil disobedience, mass mobilization, and organization. I dare say, you know, in a city like Philadelphia, when Hillary Clinton comes to Philadelphia, she can expect to be demonstrated again, as probably the Pope will be also when he comes here at the end of the summer.
The Black Lives Matter movement is only 9 months old, but we already see the changes that it's wrought in terms of the attitudes of young people especially.
Oh, yes. And you know, young people are the bellwether. They're suffering the most. They have the highest unemployment. They're the ones being killed in the street by the cops. And in a city like this, black young people, now that they have a voice, now that they're mobilized, now that they're organized, and their voices are very powerful, are saying in no uncertain terms that the ballot and, frankly, reform is not what they're interested in. They're interested in fundamental change, and for them, fundamental change will not come about through the ballot.
So what is the logic of this movement as you see it? Where does it take us?
You know, I don't want to exaggerate, but this is a crisis. On the one side, you have the forces of the 1%, the oligarchs, and those who run the mechanisms of the state and government. And on the other side, you have this growing movement of young people. This is classic. This is a classic political clash, which undermines the whole mythology and symbolism of so-called liberal democracy, where the government governs on the basis of a consensus. Sometimes the Republicans win, sometimes the Democrats win, but it's legitimacy of the system, of the process. Now we have a delegitimizing of the system and of the process, and hence a profound political crisis. And where it's going to lead, you know, it's hard to say right now. But what is clear is that the demonstrations will continue.
The center of gravity of the movement, or at least the center of attention, moved from Ferguson, a small town, 20,000 people mm-hmm. or so, controlled by white folks, to mm-hmm. a major American city, 60-something Absolutely. Percent black, and nominally controlled mm-hmm. by black folks. How did that change the nature of the confrontation?
Oh, I think in huge ways. You know, because it exposed the very nature of the black governing class, that they govern for the same interests and on behalf of the same interests that the white governing class does. Baltimore is a city of consequence. Philadelphia and Chicago are cities of greater consequence. I know here in Philly they say that we're about 43 blacks, about 43% of the population, but most black people who even think about these things say that we're at least 53%. The undercount of black people in the city of Philadelphia is unbelievable. So I think Michael Nutter, the current mayor, who is now being replaced in these elections, was so anti-black that even the most sympathetic black folks had to reject his style. But I think the collapse of the black political class is a part of the collapse of the political system itself. And just like in Ferguson and in South Carolina and in Baltimore, they told the likes of Al Sharpton to stay out. In Philadelphia, at demonstrations, when certain of the black political leaders showed up, the young leaders of these demonstrations actually cursed them out and told them to leave the demonstrations. So I don't see much of a future for them. I think a new leadership will be forged in the course of the marches and the demonstrations and the civil disobedience. I think that's what we're looking at now. We've entered a new era in the history of the country. What is significant is that these demonstrations against police murders are not just against police murders, but they're demonstrations against the police state itself.
You're an academic, but more than that, you're a lifelong activist, and you deal very closely with young people, both as an academic and as a fellow activist. Mm-hmm. What kind of new cadre is coming up out of the ranks of these struggles?
You know, what I see are young people are committed to struggle. Their eyes have been opened. What they see, they don't like. And what they don't like, they want to change. Now, in terms of their development ideologically and philosophically, it's uneven. Some of them are very, very mature, very, very ideologically developed. Others are not so developed. And then, of course, you get those who bring various forms of petty bourgeois ideas into the movement. Those are mainly young people who are recent graduates of elite universities, or people who have recently gotten masters or PhDs, and some of whom even see this movement as a way to add to their resumes. But I think the center of gravity of this movement is with the grassroots. Now, how do we know this? What are some of the indications of this? I think the rejection of Michael Eric Dyson's attack upon Cornell. I think if you look at young people, it was almost completely, I mean, it was almost complete among young people, young activists, that Michael Eric Dyson was out of his mind, did not speak for the movement, and they rejected him. At the same time, they embraced Cornell. I can see certain things, especially here, with the way young people are embracing Mumia and his struggle at this time, in the recent turnout for the 30th anniversary of the bombing of the Move House in West Philadelphia. You see all of these young people who are expressing solidarity with Move, their rejection of this kind of police terrorism, but at the same time expressing a real deep solidarity with Mumia. So these are indications when the youth are identifying themselves clearly and unequivocally with the likes of, you know, Cornell, who is an activist and who puts his body on the line, and Mumia, who is a radical and a thinker and so on.
You seem to be saying that 2016 will not be like previous election cycles when people's causes and struggles were all subsumed by the hoopla of billion-dollar electioneering.
It's not going to be that way. I think the crisis is too deep. I think in a lot of ways the governing class is incapable of mobilizing a kind of a process to legitimate themselves among the masses of people. Black people are the most alienated of any section of the population, but also the most prepared and ready to be mobilized to bring about change. You know, I think we're looking at a movement that will supersede the civil rights movement. I think the issues that it is dealing with are far deeper and more profound and of greater consequence than the civil rights movement, and that is the question of the state. And, you know, I said previously that this is a movement against the police state, but as such, it is also a movement to block the full development of a fascist authoritarian form of rule in the United States.
And so in that sense, alienation is not a negative thing. It's a healthy thing to be alienated from a rotten system.
That's right. That's right. Because it is not just a kind of a nihilism. It is a separation and alienation from the but also a solidarity with the people and with a future that is different from what we're living through now. And by the way, you know, I don't exclude from the symbols and icons of the people's movements, the Edward Snowdens and other whistleblowers who have and are the national security state and its machinations and how democracy and other privacy matters and liberties are being undermined by our very government. I don't separate, you know, voices like Medea Benjamin, the peace activist, and her colleagues who regularly carry out civil disobedience at congressional hearings on war and other things. So these forces coming together, the anti-police state, security state, the anti-war, pro-peace, the anti-1%, the anti-oligarchs, the anti-authoritarian forces, all of these are coming together to produce what must be considered a historic movement of the people. And I think a movement that will have sustainability. It will run up against a great deal of resistance. But the fact that it rejects all of the symbols of the status quo, especially those black misleaders and apologists who are touted by the corporate media as our leaders, the fact that these people are being rejected is not insignificant.
Dr. Tony Montero, speaking from Philadelphia. Paul Jay, the senior editor of the Baltimore-based Real News Network, recently held a studio discussion on the direction of the Black Lives Matter movement. On hand were Dr. Cornell West of Union Theological Seminary, Marshall Eddie Conway, the former Black Panther who served 44 years as a political prisoner and is now a producer at the Real News Network, and Reverend Osagyefu Sekou, who was recently posted to Ferguson, Missouri by the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Senior editor Paul Jay asked all three guests where they think the movement is going. The response begins with Dr. West, followed by Marshall Conway and Reverend Sekou.
I think we had to always put it in context that so many of the slave insurrections actually began when they buried the babies. When you begin to mistreat the children, people reach the edge of the tether, as it were, and they're willing to throw down collectively, sometimes individually. Well, Baltimore is part of that long history of black resistance. It would go from slave patrol to the police. It would go from the plantation to the hood. And it means self-defense, self-determination, self-respect. The problem of black people for 400 years is too many early deaths, too much poverty, not enough self-love. You connect that self-respect to a willingness to organize and mobilize, tell the fundamental truth about a vicious system. And that system undergoes different transformations. It could be slave-based capitalism. It could be industrial capitalism. Now it's a financialized monopoly capitalism with its repressive apparatus, police and so forth, with the ideological apparatus of the educational system and the entertainment system. And when folk are able to see through it, keep track of the suffering, provide alternative conceptions of reality and the world, better, more liberating conceptions of what it means to be in the world, then I think we're in a new day. And I think we're approaching that new day, what I call it, the Ferguson-Baltimore moment. Now, how do you sustain it? There's always two basic responses: repression on the one hand, co-optation on the other. Kill them off, buy them off. That's how ruling classes have attempted to respond to resistance. And we just have to tell our precious young folk that, yes, repression is always already operating, and co-optation is always already operating. Be mindful of that to be able to sustain the movement.
Eddie, same question.
Yeah, I think it's important to look at the 60s and understand that when you had that development of black unity, people unity, alternative cultural movements, et cetera, anti-war, that momentum gained international perspective. And at that point, the government and capital decided to disinvests in America. They actually offshored. I mean, if you look back at Mexico, you look back at India, you look back at China, you'll see that the industries left. When the industries left, several things happened. One is the blue-collar workforce that was the basis for the various movements became impoverished, and they lost the little resources that they had. At the same time that was happening, there was a very vicious attack, COINTELPRO, on all the movements, not just the Black Panther Party. It was on the American Indian movement. It was on the students, SDS. It was on the anti-war movement. It was on the Latinos and the Puerto Ricans. Across the board, leadership and organizations were infiltrated, sabotaged, destroyed, and key members were in prison. As this happened, the best and the brightest in a lot of those different various communities were then brought off with model cities programs. They were brought off with grants, and they were brought off with funding from Ford Foundation and other foundations. And so they took them out of the mix. They moved them out of the communities and made them upward mobile, and they locked up the most militant and the most progressive in the communities and put them away or ran them out of the country. And then they impoverished the entire community by offshoring industry. When they offshored that industry, they left a community without resources and young people and other people. Then, I mean, there's a connection between the drugs coming back from Vietnam, and there's a connection between the mafia and drugs all of a sudden flooding into our community with the Superflies and the Mac and various different concepts. All of a sudden, you had drugs saturating poor communities across the country. You had weapons saturating communities that at one point did not, they had weapons, but they did not have weapons of the caliber that flooded into the community. That became the new economy for the community. That economy then was used to further destroy the community by creating all of these different robberies to control the territory and to control the resources. And street organizations, what most people call gangs, were made in America. And they've used it in various capacities throughout history, whether it was the mafia or whether it was against the Native Americans, et cetera. They drug populations, they divided populations, they turned them against each other, and then they stood back and they enjoyed the benefits of the chaos and the conflict. So I think one of the things that needs to happen, and I think right now, today, we're at a point where, okay, you've kind of hit ground floor. They've sabotaged everything. They've impoverished everything. They've kind of like taken away all the resources. There's nothing left there. There's no down. Now people can organize and go up. But the only way they can organize and go up is they got to go into the communities that's been impoverished, that's been under attack. They got to wed themselves. They got to get back to the communities and rebuild those communities and build institutions that will sustain those communities. And there's nothing that the government can do but attack those institutions and expose itself, and not just the government, but people of economic interest. If they do that, that will further allow people to see and understand that this doesn't work, and this arrangement doesn't work in their interest. But I'm going to stop right there.
Reverend Seiko, you're the younger veteran at the table. When you hear about the history of the 60s and start experiencing the awakening, you've been in Ferguson, what do you learn from it, and what do you think in terms of how this moment gets sustained?
Well, I think there are a couple. I'm just struck by the fact that the year I was born, you went inside. And And so what does that mean for that generation of freedom fighters who found themselves behind the wall and the high level of repression that you all experience, and the mere fact that you're still fighting, for me, is something to draw inspiration from. And so I want to say thank you. Thank you. And then secondly, I think, you know, while we articulate a deep vision of Slavoj Žižek says it this way, that nostalgia is a form of mourning because the present is too unbearable and the future is unforeseeable. And so one of the things that we often do with young people is that we often engage in a romance about the 60s. Right, so 19, particularly a romance out of my particular class, the clergy class, right, that every preacher over 40 marched with Martin Luther King, right? 1958, 1961, Martin Luther King has to lead the National Baptist Convention, create the Progressive Baptist Convention with 2,000 other clergy, because the black pope, John H. Jackson, does not want civil rights to be a part of the mainstay of the National Baptist Convention. You know, every time I go around the country, you know, everybody I meet, they tell me they were on the bridge in Selma. And the reality is that if all the people who say they were on the bridge and the bridge were actually on the bridge would have collapsed, right? So the reality is that part of it is that we don't want to set a mythology up for young people that they can never aspire to by engaging in a form of nostalgia. That's not the same as a celebration. That's not the same as honoring those who have come before us. But it is to say that there was while it was mass, that mass was still small in the context of this large space that we call America. So I want to tamper any romanticism and nostalgia. And then secondly, what's unique about this particular moment is that Ferguson in particular looks, and Baltimore, and particularly those images in Baltimore, looks more like an intifada than it does the civil rights movement. And that is in part because of the collapse of the global economy, in which we see in 2008 some 40 million people go into poverty overnight, and then the high level of disrespect. So whether it be the brother in Tunisia who sets himself on fire because of the act of disrespect, characterized by two features of this particular spring, right, whether it be Black Spring or Arab Spring, occupation of public space, Tahrir Square, West Florissant, Penn and North, and the rejection of traditional leadership, the outright disdain for those leaders who have served to tamper social movement and placate the realities of those who live on the night side of American democracy. And so the uniqueness of this moment in that sense offers a possibility for young people to assess themselves in light of these historical truths and in light of this contemporary moment. In terms of sustaining the moment, I think that sustenance is threefold. I think it's that in Ferguson, what we call the turn up in the street, right, everyday people, primarily black, lumping proletariat, but dignified, saying, no, you're not going to do this. So if it's relatives, if it's high schoolers in Baltimore saying, I'm going home, I don't care how many riot police out here, right? Or if it's young people constantly in front of the police station in Ferguson, right? So that level of the turn up in the street, creating the political space, because social movements are thermometers, are thermostats, right? They set political climate. So young people in the street, day in, day out, opening up the political space, and then elections, public policy, and legislation are the thermometers. They measure the political climate predicated on what kind of turn up has been in the street. So I think the turn up is essential. Two, I think it's going to be around the question of what internal work that we are doing in terms of with Brother Conway, man. What are the ways in which black communities are going to self-organize themselves outside of the specter of the state? So whether through cooperatives, through feeding programs, through building upon the work of the Black Panther Party and others in terms of feeding folks and that kind of thing, self-organizations, cop watch, self-patrols, those kinds of things in terms of the kind of internal work where folks feel that they have a buy-in in the space, the geographies that they occupy. And then the third one is a spiritual question, and I don't mean it necessarily connected to a holy other. I'm not trying to recruit anybody, right? Although Brother Conway could be, you know, my pastor any day. But it is to say that what are the ways in which we look at these material conditions and be able to pull upon non-material forces, right? So when you look at Albert Camus' Meditation on Suicide, when you look at the material conditions, you understand how it arrives at the conclusion that it's an ethical possibility. Just it was made rationally. We can't win. But through our music, our dance, our culture, our art, the best of our preaching, right, that we are able to grab on some kind of, we're able to grab a kind of a non-material force. So my grandmama sang a song, "This joy that I have, the world didn't give it to me and the world can't take it away." It's this ability to be able to look at the material conditions and call them a lie. And so I think part of it is, what are the ways in which we can love each other through this work? How can we care for each other, right? How can we not reproduce the imperial capacity to shame, to discipline, to punish, right? So how in our social movements can we love each other in such a way? And that's in part because when our elders come and see about us, right? So Cornell coming to see about us in Ferguson, coming to see about us in Baltimore, is what you're doing with these young folks here, the leaders of the Beautiful Struggle and the Algebra Project, right? That when our elders come to see about us and say, we may not understand it all, it don't really make sense, you know, y'all a little profane and you sag your pants and you're gender nonconforming, we don't really understand any of that, but you're ours and we're going to love you through it.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.